So where does this idea of the Myers-Briggs type indicator, which is a nice scientific sounding name for something someone invented, come from? Well, back in the 1910, 1920s, that sort of era, Jung was writing about personalities and came up with this, amazing insight that some people prefer to think logically, whilst other people prefer to be tangibly in the actual world outside. Some people like ideas, some people like things. Some people like to feel and intuit things, some people like to work them out logically and rationally. So basically, he's just making observations about polarities that exist in the outside world. And he happened to choose four types of polarities as what he considered to be the most important type. Later on in the 1920s, a mother and daughter team, Isabel Myers and Catherine Briggs, decided to kind of team up and see if they can turn what Jung had created into actually a nice little test to sort people into different things, into different categories. So basically, they created questionnaires designed to ask specific questions around: do you feel, do you think, are you extroverted, are you introverted? And rather than asking people, are you extroverted or introverted, they basically turned around and thought, what does extroversion mean? How does a extroverted person think or react? And just ask questions: do you have this reaction? Do you think in this way? Do you have that reaction? Do you think in that way? And vice versa. If they'd answered yes, that meant one tick in the box. If they answered no, that meant 1 point for the other box. And then you just add up points. You add a point in the extroversion box, point in the introversion box, point in the sensing box, intuiting box, etc. Eventually, all you have to do is count up the number of points you have. And if there are more points in the extroversion box than the introversion points, that means you're extroverted. That's it. It's not that you're a little bit of both and you prefer one. It's that you're extroverted and that is it. Even if you go over by 1 point, you're still extroverted and that is it. So again, there's a bit of a logical flaw going on here. They can't necessarily say that just because you have more of one than the other, that you're exclusively one, but they do like to have that exclusivity as part of the philosophy embedded in the Myers-Briggs type indicator. Essentially, this whole questioning process was formalized in the 1940s and 1942, and this was after having administered thousands of times, tweaked it, changed the questions a little bit, and then asked people to feedback on whether or not they thought it was true and accurate and so on. But here's an interesting thing. Of course, it's going to be true and accurate, especially the character profiles are developed. Because if you ask someone, do you prefer to think logically or do you prefer to be intuitive? And you ask that same question 100 times over in different ways, and someone says 80 times, I prefer the logical version than the intuitive version. And then later on in the character profile, you say, you're X type of person, which means you like to think logically, you like to solve things rationally, and so on. From time to time, you still use your intuition a little bit, but you really prefer the whole rational, logical working things out. You'll tend towards mathematics and yada, 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 yada. Well, guess what? Of course, they're going to say yes. They just told you this. They just told you this in the way they answered the question. So basically, they're studying kind of a tautology. I answered the question this way, I'm that way. Oh my God, I must be. So this is basically the science behind the Myers-Briggs types indicator. Now, it's interesting that the four basic patterns that we've covered as well tend to emerge here also. So I'm not knocking Myers-Briggs. I'm not saying Myers-Briggs is useless. All I'm saying is that people build it up to be much more than it really is. You already have the tools to basically discover that each of the 16 Myers-Briggs types just by using the four personality types as your starting point. That's something you can tell within a few minutes of talking to someone. And then starting to probe them a little bit to find out some of the other little details. Are they options oriented or are they certainty oriented? Are they extrovert or are they more introverted? Now, depending on the context and what kind of questions you can ask them, you can do that in a couple of minutes, or it may have to take a little bit longer to kind of weave that in to get genuine results. But either way, you end up having, in a very short period of time, just in a conversation, the same information that a long and complex paper and pencil test does. And you'll be probably just as accurate. In fact, if you want to, you could spend a couple of $100 and bring in a whole bunch of people, have them measured according to these tests. Don't look at the results, profile them yourself, and then judge how closely does your version of it come to the test version of it. And all that'll happen is you'll get a sense of how close are you to perceiving them, to how they perceive themselves. Now, Myers-Briggs is very interesting because it's kind of spawned a whole bunch of other ideas. And really, this idea of 16 personalities that break down into four core categories with variations within them, This is something which actually comes up time and time again throughout the psychological and philosophical literature. The best place to find out more about this is a man called David Kearsey. Now, he decided that Myers-Briggs had something going for them and had to add his own little distinction into it. And basically, he's asking the same kinds of questions. He's, of course, he's using his own questions because in order to use Myers or Myers-Briggs questions, he has to pay Myers-Briggs a trademark fee. But if he creates his own versions of them, then it's okay, it's free. And so he created his own version, trademarked that, and now you have to pay him for that or buy his book and run yourself through it. And he came up with exactly the same four categories that you're familiar with. He mapped them onto certain functions in Myers-Briggs, for example, the fire type, which Plato would call the artisan, and so would David Kearsey, would be what he called the SPs. And SP stands for, of course, people who are sensing and perceiving in the Myers-Briggs profile. Remember, we're talking about sensing versus intuition, which basically means are you concrete or abstract in thinking? And the P, it stands for either judging or perceiving, in other words, certainty versus options, which is kind of an indirect test for right and left brain thinking. So basically, an SP is a concrete right brain thinker. An SJ is a concrete left brain thinker. J, remember, is judging, which is more left brain function. So what's a concrete left brain thinker? Well, that's the same as the earth type, which Plato would have called a guardian, and 100 other people call different names, but really are the same thing. The water type, the idealist, he would call an NF. N stands for intuition, remember? Intuition basically being the function of abstraction, your thinking, your thoughts. F standing for feeling as opposed to thinking. Feeling, of course, being a right brain function versus the thinking, rational left brain function. Finally, the NTs, who in other words, intuition versus sensing, so they're inside their heads in the abstract realm. T being thinking versus feeling, so more rational, logical thought. That's, in other words, we have abstract logical thinkers. We're right back to our air personalities, what Plato would have called the rationals. And now we are right back again where we started off. We've got the four core personality types. We have all the different subtypes underneath it once you start adding other variations, other poles. And how do you find these out? Well, people fill out a form. Do you do this or do you do that? Do you think this way or do you think that way? Do you prefer this or do you prefer that? And just by asking these questions, guess what? You create a profile. You just put numbers in a box. Each time someone answers yes to this and no to that, it's a one or a zero. You add up all the number of ones. And if there's more ones in one pole than the other, then you are, quote unquote, you are that pole. I don't believe that's the case. I think you just tend more towards that pole because maybe you've practiced it more, or maybe there is a genuine thing such as nature which predisposes you more towards that pole. It actually doesn't really matter to me. What matters is that right now, in this context, you are tend towards that pole much more, and that's more something that I can predict. I know that over time, unless something significant happens in your life, you'll actually stay that way just because of inertia. Why change if it's working for you, right? So I can give a pretty educated guess of how you'll be in the future in a similar situation, more of what you already were. And at that point, the psychometric does tend to create a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. But there's no magic behind it. The magic is an understanding. What are you looking for? You're looking for poles. What poles are you looking for? Well, we've given you a whole bunch of them already. If you want more, you just look at these instruments, you look at the questions, and instantly you'll recognize, oh, I know, this is the kind of pole these people are looking for. Now, something interesting that David Kearsey does in his particular book, it's a book called Please Understand Me, is that he maps all the four basic functions, earth, fire, air, and water, onto the philosophical and psychological literature of the last 2,000 years. So it starts all the way with, I think it doesn't go back all the way to the Bible, to Ezekiel, but it starts with either Plato or Galen, so one of the very early philosophers, and says, okay, here are his four basic types. Well, here are the next four basic types which correspond in exactly the same way. Here are another four that correspond in the same way, and another four, and another four, and another four. It's always four types, always the same kind of characteristics associated to them. And throughout history, it's just different names being applied to different things, but really, it's the same patterns re-emerging. I'll give you an example just to pull out some more wacky and crazy things that are out there. There is a interesting philosopher and doctor, actually, from Vienna in the kind of Dark Ages period called Paracelsus. That wasn't his real name, that's just he called himself that because there's a very famous doctor in a preceding era called Celsus. And he basically was calling himself Paracelsus to say, I am better than Celsius. And Paracelsus also noticed that there are these different personality types. He probably also read Galen, the physician, who came up with the four humors theories, because it sounds very similar. He created these esoteric types, calling them salamanders and nymphs and gnomes and sylphs, which are more, shall we say, occult-sounding titles. But they were just fun ways for him to basically say earth, fire, air, and water. These are the different natures. And he documents exactly the same natures all over again. Later on, you had psychologists trying to bring in some philosophical background to their ideas. So people like Attica and Fromm, creating their own little profiles. But again, they're just looking at subsets of the same four personality types. Some looking at for them from the point of problems. You know, when these people become irrational, this is the kind of problem that they tend towards. When these people get sick, neurotic, or psychotic, these are the kind of psychoses that they'll tend to develop, and so on. But basically, the four same types develop over and over again. Now, rather than take up your valuable time talking about all those four types across history, etc., all I'll do is, if you look at your manual, I just put them in a table form. You'll have earth, fire, and water across the top, and you'll be able to instantly zip down and you'll go, oh, okay, when Fromm talks about this type of person, he means an air type. When Attica talks about another person, he means this kind of person. When Plato talks about them, when Aristotle talks about them, when Paracelsus talks about them, when Myers-Briggs talks about them, these are the same types, they're just different names for what we already know. So rather than having to try and break your head and go, there's so many different systems and so many different names and so many different things, that's just part of the naming problem all over again. People think that these things are different because they have different names. But when you look at the content, the substance of it, they're pretty much the same thing. Sure, the emphasis is one direction rather than another, but they really are virtually identical with a few little variations in terms of theory and really nothing else than that. I'd like to give you just one more example of this before I move on to some other types of psychometrics, which again have similarities. There's a psychometric evaluation or a test which is very popular with large corporations called the Hermann Brain Dominance Indicator. Basically, it was developed by a man called Hermann, hence William Hermann, hence Hermann. It uses the metaphor of right brain and left brain thinking, so brain dominance. And basically, he's done the same thing. He's reinvented the wheel. He's done the same thing you've done. He's just giving them his own names. So in the Hermann Brain Dominance Indicator, basically the idea is we have two types of people, right brain and left brain dominated, and we, each of those two groups can be subdominated on subhemispheres or some other weird rationale, so that you end up having your analytical thinkers, well, that's airs of course. You have your sequential thinkers, which are more the earth type. Basically, we're talking about the left brain functions at abstract and concrete levels. Then you have the interpersonal thinkers, which are fire, and the imaginative thinkers, which are water. So we're talking about the right brain thinking on an abstract and a concrete level. So really right back to the exact same point. And organizations, here's the irony. As a coach, as an executive coach, I'd go into organizations and I actually would use these different tests, partly because they are fun to do, partly because they expect them, and partly because personally, the only way I used to use them wasn't actually to read people. I was doing that already separately. The real reason for these tests is if there's conflict in a team, you can blame the test. So you do a Myers-Briggs test and say, hey guys, you are, an SP type, or in a Hermann test, you're an analytical thinker, but you are an interpersonal thinker. And so you're talking about rational things and you're talking about people things, and hence you're conflicting because your language is wrong for each other. And you think he's, stabbing in the back, but he's really doing something at a different level to you, and yada, yada, yada. Hence, let's all be friends. It's a really good way of burying the hatchet over a conflict that have grown up over a long period of time by saying it's not your fault, it's not your fault, it's just that you're miscommunicating on different levels. There are elements of truth in that, but as a reframe goes, it made my job as a coach so much easier because I could start from a plain level field, rebuild damaged relationships without people's egos being bruised and all those things getting in the way. Now, as an executive coach, another thing that I noticed was that, and this is again bizarre, organizations love these tests. HR, being, I guess, very kind of water or fire oriented people, love this idea of getting into people and, seeing the different personalities and whatever. And they would happily administer, up to half a dozen of these tests per individual, paying anywhere between $20 and $200 per test and getting the same information. So you had people doing Myers-Briggs, CISIS, and Herman Brain Dominance, which essentially are giving you the same information, but they're paying it for it, to different people. And because the questions are a little different and the labels are a little different, they think it's different. But when you actually look at the substance, even the character profiles that are being supplied mechanically afterwards, they're virtually identical. It's just they've been re the same paragraph's been rewritten by a different hand, and people think they've got more information. They don't. What it does do, though, is it has prevents them from having to think, and it seems like a fun sort of thing to do. So if you find people like that, and you could actually make yourself a nice little business this way, just create three or four different type indicators based on the four types for earth, air, fire, and water. Have two different, four different questionnaires, one maybe 60 questions long, another one up to 300 questions long, and so on. Ask different questions each time. Come up with slightly variations in terms of the character profiles that pop out of it at the other end, and then you can just sell four different things to the same organization. They'll happily buy it. It's bizarre. I've tried to explain it to them, and they still buy it anyway. They see the logic of it, but they'll still want to buy it. So, if they're going to waste the money on it, they may as well waste it on you, as far as I'm concerned. Anyway, putting my cynicism aside for a moment, let's look at some of the other tests you might come across, which seem very different on the surface. But when you start actually looking underneath the surface, you'll see the similar patterns developing. There's a test called the Strength Deployment Inventory, which basically asks questions to map you across one of three functions. So rather than using poles, it's using three poles rather than two poles. The po three poles they're using are people orientation, task orientation, and process orientation. So basically, people orientation is what we talked about in the polarity, people versus tasks. Are you results focused, results at any cost, versus are you people focused, which means you look after the people, make sure the team's okay, even if it means sacrificing the result. The third pole, which is the process-oriented pole, is basically looking for an earth-type character within that matrix. So what you're really looking at in this, in some respects, is a mixture of a water-type tendency in the people orientation, a fire type tendency, or maybe a little bit of a air type tendency in the task orientation, and an earth type tendency when it comes towards the process, doing things by the rules and so on and so forth. But now that you understand that, all you have to do is to create questions around that, the kind of questions that allow you to separate between tasks, between process, in other words, following the rules, and between people. Once you do that, you just add up the scores in exactly the same way. You create a nice complex looking matrix with bells and wheels and charts and numbers and lines, and you have 50 million steps before people can actually find the right position in the chart. And by making it really complex, it's like the shaman coming out with an extra big rattle and really, really colorful feathers. And because he sings extra loud, it must be more powerful. Hey, it's just part of the psychology behind these tests. I don't think people do them on purpose. It's just people get carried away with it. And so start reading more into it than really is there. Another example of this is the DISC. This is something which, again, particularly with coaches, is very, very familiar, or rather, a lot of coaches like to use a DISC assessment. DISC basically stands for four poles that you're looking for: dominance, influence, steadiness, and conscientiousness, which essentially is starting to split hairs around one simple pole: extroversion versus introversion. If you are extroverted, you will want to dominate others or influence them. If you're introverted, you tend to be more either conscientious or steady. In other words, conscientious, like hard working, getting things done. Steadiness being more reliable, earth type quality. So now the psychologist, based on this, is by the way, based on the work of a psychologist called William Marsden in the 1920s, and it was then later developed by a man called Gaia. And basically, he's just taking one simple poll. And he's thought about it enough to split into four sub-poles, the DISC poles, this dominance, influence, that is, and conscientiousness, and just developed a whole bunch of questions around each one of those four basic variants. And then here you go, here's your profile. Your profile is high dominance, a little bit of influence, high steadiness, low conscientiousness, and that makes you type A. And in type B, you're this, and type C, you're that. Basically, we're right back to the four types again, only this time, the only thing we're really looking for is extroversion versus introversion. Now, do you think you'd sell anywhere near as much if the DISC assessment was called "Are you an extrovert?" test? No, but basically, that's what they are testing for. So when you understand these things, you again, have more range of what to do with it. You can actually do specific tests on any one of those poles, and you can spend hours, years working out extra detailed questions and putting them out there, refining them, making long pencil tests, and so on. I'll show you exactly how to do that in a moment. But really, you're doing the same thing on a just more, shall we say, complex scale that you've already learned to do. And personally, I'm not convinced that the results you get are that much more valuable than the 5-minute version is. And that's not even including the idea that the 5-minute version gets a chance to grow and evolve over time because you're constantly updating it, versus the paper and pencil version, which is frozen in time because once it's done, you consider it to be done. Now, the final idea I want to bring up for you is something which you might come across if you start looking into this area. And just to be aware of it, and more because it's useful for you in terms of finding more sources for polls, this is called the Big Five. Essentially, back in the 1930s and 40s, people came up with the idea of, well, actually, the idea of lexical analysis was posited back in the 19th century. The idea is if you want to try and find out between characters, what kind of characters are out there? What kind of personalities exist in the world? Well, we should look at language, because if certain types of people exist in the world, then we will have created words to describe those people. So we can separate between John and Paul and Mary and Sue by the language, by saying Paul is these adjectives, Mary is these adjectives, and so on. So if you go to a dictionary and you pull out all the words that describe people, and then you take these words and you get people to use them by actually, applying them to different types of people, and you just add up the number of times it's used over another, then you end up developing groups and you find out, oh, okay, there are certain patterns that keep developing over and over in a society. Hence, these must be important characteristics in that society. The idea is called the lexical analysis. So the idea is you take words and you find out how often those words are used and where they're used, and as a result of analyzing that data, it tells you what kind of personalities exist. Again, there are some flaws in terms of what the numbers mean, but it's very interesting, the idea of tracking language as a means of finding out what people pay attention to, at least. So it's not necessarily that these characters exist uniquely. I think it's more a question of what characters people like to pay attention to. And that might be a pragmatic value in the sense that these type of characteristics might be very useful in day-to-day functioning inside the world. So back in the 1930s and 40s, the way this idea of lexical analysis was taken up was that a bunch of psychologists basically went through a dictionary and pulled out some, I don't know, 3, 4, 5,000 words which describe people. And then later on, those lists were simplified down to about 170 or so words. Then they were applied to different people. Basically, you sat down and you asked, okay, Peter over there is which of these things? Paul over there is which of these things? And so on and so on and so on. What happens, of course, is that individuals start conglomerating certain characteristics. So there are certain traits that basically fall under the same overall heading. And as people will have you believe, there are five big headings. Depending on who you talk to, some will talk about the big three, some big seven, big nine. PF16 is looking at 16 different versions of this. But I like the big five because they give you some interesting poles to play with. And again, poles are just poles. They allow you to basically be sensitive to information and create a more valuable information as a result of it. In other words, by looking for certain things, you'll find them. By finding them, you'll know what to do with them. By using that knowledge, you develop a pragmatic toolkit which applies to that kind of concept. So, what are the big five? Very simply, they are openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism. What do those things mean? Well, most of them you're already familiar with. So, when you come across them again, you'll be able to go, oh, yeah, I recognize what these are. Openness is really about right brain functions like your ability to deal with your emotions, your ability to be imaginative, to enjoy experiences. If you score high on openness, that means you're scoring high on right brain activities, hence you would say right brain dominant. Conscientiousness, on the other hand, looks for certain types of left brain activities, particularly self-discipline, dutiful achievement. Basically, we're looking more for earth type qualities, so the earth elemental types. And these are things, again, that we tend to look for a lot in people. How conscientious are they or not? Then we have extroversion, okay? Extroversion, we're pretty familiar with by now, extroversion versus introversion. The interesting difference here is that they have a wider definition of extroversion, so not just about seeking other people and company and versus being more quiet or retiring and so on. They do use extroversion for seeking stimulation and sensation in general, rather than just company of others. So company of others is part of it, being sociable is part of it, but seeking stimulation in general is how the Big Five would actually categorize extroversion. Next, we come with agreeableness. Agreeableness is really a fire and water type right brain function, which is your ability to be compassionate, empathetic, to connect with other people, to be approachable, versus being suspicious, hostile, and so on. Finally, we have neuroticism. Neuroticism is one of the, in fact, the only of the Big Five traits that we really haven't looked at properly yet. And I think it's a very valuable pole to pay attention to. Basically, neuroticism is a person's tendency to feel negative emotions. If you score low neurotic, it means you tend to be quite an optimist. If you score high on neuroticism, you'll probably be quite a pessimist. But more than optimism and pessimism, which is more about your attitudes towards life in terms of are good or bad things going to happen, your expectations, neuroticism covers a wider range of negative and positive emotions. So being happy would be a low neuroticism. Being angry a lot would be high neuroticism. Now you can be an angry optimist, whereas you couldn't be angry all the time and score low neuroticism. So whereas optimism is a more refined subcategory of neuroticism, neuroticism in general gives you pleasant information or useful information in terms of how positive, happy, etc. How are that is that person in general terms? Again, as a coach or a therapist, this is very valuable information because it tells you how much harder you're going to have to work. Very positive, very low neurotic type people will be easier to work with. You'll get results more quickly. There's going to be less baggage for you to have to deal with, and vice versa. High neurotics, you'll probably have to work with slower. There'll be more baggage you have to deal with, more safeguards you've got to build in place first. But that just tells you a little bit of information, which after a while you internalize, so that when a person comes in and tells you a certain type of problem, in a certain tone of voice, with certain tones of rhythms and language and so on and so forth, you go, I think I know where I'm going with this. And it builds a very accurate picture for you. So I'm going to finish here talking about the different tests and psychological instruments that are out there, purely and simply because I hope you realize by now that they're all pretty repetitive. They have different names. They sound different. The profiles that are developed as a result of it initially on the surface look like they give you vastly different information, but underneath it, they're really saying the same thing in different words. They're looking at the same pie through a different eyeglass, if I can use a completely random metaphor. What I'm interested in now is how do you turn all that knowledge, how do you do your own test so that if you do become a coach, if you do want to do this in a corporation or introduce it just for the hell of it, that you can create a valid test, one that gives you valuable information or as valid as any of these other tests are, and that you don't have to pay $100 for in order to actually run the test. So there are basically five steps to creating your own test, your own psychometric. The unwritten sixth step or first step before the five actually begin is actually understanding the basic idea of polarities and how they combine into creating different types of characters. I like the basic idea of the four elements, the four character types, just because it's a very simple thing that you can see in the world. It's been used in philosophy a lot of times. It's part of kind of what we're looking people for in people anyway. Those aren't the only distinctions you can draw. You can actually create all kinds of different connections and interactions. It's just nice to have a base to work from. So assuming they're going to use those four types as a base, and you're going to use poles that you're going to add on top of it as a way of creating complexity so you can create, 16, 32, 48, and however many other character types are out there. How do you actually go around creating a quote-unquote systematic method that is, and again, quote unquote, scientifically valuable? Well, essentially, what you do is you start off by choosing your priorities. Your priorities are basically going to be looking at what types of poles do I want to look for. So the DISC assessment essentially looks for extroversion versus introversion, and then just goes into a lot of detail around that. The Myers-Briggs essentially looks at the four character types, but just evolves them to 16 types with variations within a theme, and so forth. So you choose the polls that are going to be useful in that context. If it's, for example, a question of salesmanship, you might look at extroversion versus introversion. Why? Because extroverted salespeople tend to go out there and sell more. They deal with people more. However, the opposite might be true. In a sales process, which involves very high-ticket items, where it's all about a very personal relationship built up over a long period of time, introversion can have significant advantages, like stick-to-itiveness, the fact that they build relationships more solidly because they go into depth a lot more. So you might look for introversion there as well. So these are little things you start looking for. You've got to decide what does this task or this kind of environment, what kind of characters does it need? What kind of profiles does it need in order to be successful? Next thing you do is you design your questions. Let's say that we're going to create the four-element test, or maybe we just call it the Ledochowski Personal Character Subdominant Brain Hemisphere Type Indicator. TM, of course. And of course, whenever you're going to apply this test, please send me $100 because just that's the way the world works. So you have this nicely laid out Ledochowski personal character, which sounds great and significant, wonderful, using your four types. And you might maybe throw one of the other couple of types in as well. So instead of having just four types, you can evolve it down to 16 or 32 or however many you want to have. Now, for each of the polls, you end up pulling out between 10 and up to 200 questions, depending on how detailed you want to get, that looks for that kind of characteristic. Here's what I mean by that. Let's say you're looking for extroversion versus introversion. Well, what is the result of extroversion? How do people behave when they're extroverted? Well, they go out and they like to meet people. At parties, they socialize more. They tend to be more talkative instead of listening. They tend to have a lot of friendship, which are kind of light friendships rather than deep friendships. Let's look at the counter profile, which would be things people who are introverted will tend to create more deep relationships. They'll have fewer friends. At parties, they'll probably stick to the corners and talk to the couple of friends they know rather than strangers. They'll probably listen more than to be talkative, etc., etc., etc. So basically, what I'm looking at is behavioral profile. How do people who are extroverted behave? How do people who are introverted behave? Then ask questions, do you behave this way or that way? We can also turn towards their thinking. How do extroverts think? How do and introverts think? For example, an extrovert might think or feel energized when they meet complete strangers, whereas an introvert might feel more energized when they're on their own and involved in their own thoughts. So now we're talking about behaviors as well as internal processes. Now you create a whole bunch of questions. I've already created five for you off the top of my head there. You can make it anywhere between 10 and 200, depending on how sophisticated, complex, realistic you want your test to be. And you go into the next poll and you do the same thing. Let's say we're talking about concrete versus abstraction. What do concrete people do? Well, they're in the world of senses. So do you pay attention more to the things you see, things you can see, hear, touch, taste, and feel? Or are you more a person, are you more interested in ideas and concepts? Are you a big picture or a small detail thinker? Do you prefer people giving you the big picture of things, or do you prefer them to give you the precise step-by-step process? Here's another example of concrete versus abstract thinking. You can ask it in a negative sense. For example, do you think it's better to have your head in the clouds or to be stuck in a rut? Or which is worse, to be stuck in a rut or have your head in the clouds? So just by changing the idea a little bit, you can already come up with better questions. Abstract thinkers tend to think that being stuck in a rut is worse than having your head stuck in a cloud. Of course they do, because they've got their head stuck in the cloud all the time. Versus more concrete thinkers who are stuck in a rut much more often because that's where they pay most of their attention to. So it really isn't rocket science to come up with these questions. It's just a question of sitting down there and figuring out how to these polar opposites think and behave, and then just running about a bunch of questions out about those and then combining them. That's what step three is all about. Step three is about taking your list of questions. Let's say you have a question for each of the two poles that make the four types. And for each of those two poles that make the four types up, you're going to have 10 questions. You now have 40 questions because you have questions for each side of the pole. Those 40 questions, you want to mix up a little bit so people don't realize there's a pattern developing. If you ask questions about the same pattern over and over and over again, you'll entrain them through the consistency principle to try and give you consistent answers rather than true answers. So you basically mix them up. If you want to ask random questions, you ask random questions as well. You just ignore them later on. And as you mix them up, you get tend to get a little bit more accurate responses because the mind stays fresh because it has to go into different thinking modes more and more often. So you now have a questionnaire of anywhere between 40 and 500 questions that are totally mixed up, higgledy-piggledy. Only you know which question refers to what because you've bothered to actually keep track of that. Put that piece of paper in front of someone and say, okay, here's your questionnaire. Answer questions, it's a multiple choice. In situation X, are you more A or B? In situation B, are you more A or B? In situation C, are you more A or B? And so on. If you want to get really sophisticated, quote unquote, about this, you come up with another version of a test where you say, is A true of you? Very true, slightly true, less true, and so on. And then you take that range of responses between, highly true, which is equal to 5, not true at all, which is equal to 1. And then there are various statistical models you can use to try and turn that into actual data, statistics you can use, and yada yada. Basically, that's overcomplicating the whole matter. I strongly recommend you don't bother with it, but I know it's out there. And if you want to make it look extra cool, hey, by all means, do the mathematics behind it, use it. Just bear in mind, every time that you equate a certain state with a number, the more you start processing that number, the more the answer will tend to be divorced from reality. That's just kind of my opinion, and looking at psychometric tools and so on that do this sort of stuff, to be honest with you, that's kind of been my experience as well. Next, once you've got these questionnaires, let's say you've got a 100 question questionnaire, next thing to do is to test it. You've got to apply it. You apply it to 100 people and 1,000 people or whatever you want to do, and then you have certain predictions. Let's say you stick to the four personality types. Well, you already have predictions that apply to the four personality types. You write out your predictions, you give them to people, and then ask them, how accurate is this in terms of your profile? If they go, it's very accurate, then you're great. If they say it's not accurate at all, you go back to the drawing board. And typically, what will happen is you either tweak the questions slightly, or more usually, what's going to happen is you change a profile. The questions stay the same, it's just your answer that changes. The thing to be aware of here is something called the Forer effect. Basically, Forer was a social scientist that wanted to find out why people believe in astrology and voodoo and palm reading and, shall we say, less scientific types of procedures. And what is it that people constantly believe in them for, when scientifically speaking, they're not very valid? Of course, the valid version would be a psychological test, which is probably just as flawed. But again, I have a strong bias there, so you probably noticed. In any event, what Forer did was he went to newspapers and pulled out random sentences, character profiles from different astrological charts in the newspapers and put it together into one big paragraph. So basically, he would choose something from Aries and from this sun sign and that sun sign and the other sun sign, and he'd stick them together over a couple of weeks. So he had a nice fat paragraph. Then he ran a fake psychological test on people and gave everyone the exact same paragraph as a response, saying, you're this type of person. Please rate how accurate it is. Well, it turns out that anywhere between 80 and 90% of people said these results were hugely accurate. Now, we're saying that basically 80 to 90% of people are saying that the results that were given, they're basically identical people. Well, that's not necessarily true. As you learn more when we went into the hypnotic mind reading things, people will apply to themselves the things that apply and conveniently ignore all the rest. So you've got to be careful of the Forer effect when testing your things because, chances are people go, hey, this stuff sounds great. Sure, that's what I'm like. The way to test against the Forer effect is to create your questionnaires, give your profiles out, and then make sure you've got a control group that all gets the wrong profile, or maybe just write one profile all of them get, or you mix them up in different ways. And essentially, if when the profiles actually match the questions, you get a high response rate saying, yep, this is pretty accurate. And when you give them the opposite answers, they go, nope, this doesn't, it's not very accurate in terms of who I am. Then chances are your character profiles, in other words, the conclusions you've drawn from your questions, will be relatively accurate. And notice I'm using some precise terms here, relatively and tends to and so on. Why? Because it's all rough sketches. There's no hard science behind this. At the moment, I don't think a conceptual framework exists to make any kind of hard science even possible for this. So, you've chosen your polarities that you're interested in, you've made your predictions about it, you've designed a whole bunch of questions to find answers in terms of these predictions. You've mixed them all together in a grab bag. You've administered the test. You've given the results back to them, saying you're this type of person and here are the results as a result of it. And you've checked that people agree with them enough that you've got a reasonable level of sureness that your test works, or at least that people will accept it. At that point, the fifth step, this is the very important step, the most important of all, you put a little TM in brackets next to your test. You go off to corporations and private individuals, and you charge them about $100 per person to spend 15 minutes, filling out a paper and pencil form, or better still, you put it online, and people pay $100 to click a box online and automatically get a result, which costs you nothing, and they'll be very happy with because the profile, of course, has been tested and is going to be relatively accurate. So that is the secret to hypnotic profiling. My preference is to use it as a live tool, something you use to increase your influence and understanding of other people, something which is going to be allowed to grow with you as you interact with more people and the same person more over time as well. It's really, as far as I'm concerned, a great mechanism for training your intuitions. However, for those of you who wish to go down the more earthy type of, solid little route and writing paper and pencil tests and getting academic certifications from it and being recognized and being a world leader because of it, well, off you go. Write your questionnaires out. You've got the rules for it now. Just realize in the back of your mind that what you're doing isn't going to be as, shall we say, straightforward as everyone else is going to assume it's going to be. So, with that happy news, I'm going to leave you at the end of this masterclass. I hope you do go out there and use this as a practical tool, help people understand themselves and of course help you understand them better. And I look forward to meeting you again on a future masterclass.